Radio Netherlands presents The Research File with Laura Dernford.
The scientific mind, I would say, is something related with looking and analyzing the world in perspective of solving problems.
I really look at the scientific mind as the mind that is dedicated to rationality insofar as possible.
I think part of the scientific mind is abstract thinking.
Hello. These are just a few of the people I met recently in The Hague, here in the Netherlands. Psychologists, social scientists, physicists, medics, education experts, an artist and others gathered together for an international colloquium called Building the Scientific Mind. It was quite unlike any conference I've ever been to before. For one thing, there was a lot of debate about what the scientific mind might entail, let alone whether or not you can actually build one. The delegates from around the world all brought differing perspectives to the discussion and to questions of how scientific minds might be nurtured through better learning programs or developed more effectively to tackle problems such as HIV/AIDS. More of that in a moment. First, though, a quick word from Jan Visser, a physicist by training and now president of the Learning Development Institute, a transdisciplinary community concerned with the development and study of learning. I asked Jan why he had felt the need to organize this meeting in the first place.
It was highly necessary, in my view, from a point of view of developing human learning, in this case, in the direction in which the scientific mind goes. In all kinds of situations, we pay a lot of attention to making people more competent in specific areas. They are able to do A, B, C, and D, but we forget to think about the development of the mind, the overall picture that people have and the vision they develop of their lives and of their being in the world that guides them in applying those various competencies.
But why the scientific mind? I mean, what was your idea of the scientific mind before all of this discussion actually began?
Why the scientific mind? In the first place, it's a personal bias of mine because I am a scientist by original background and I am a passionate scientist. So I've always been asking questions to myself, why am I getting so passionate about this all? And so I have a vision of what the scientific mind entails. It's probably not complete, and that's why I wanted to have that meeting. For me, what is crucial to science is that it gives you a view of the world, of the universe, of yourself that is highly complex, highly complete. You see yourself somewhere sitting in the course of events of an evolution that started billions of years ago and that may go on billions of years again. It looks also insignificant, but on the other hand, you realize yourself that what a unique opportunity that I am here at this particular moment in the evolution, and what can I do? Well, organize a colloquium on building the scientific mind.
Which from now on I'll refer to as BTSM. Although a lot of the discussion at the meeting was often on quite an abstract level, there were some very practical goals too. One group of people focused on how the ongoing battle against HIV/AIDS might benefit if more people had scientific minds. 2 decades of projects to inform people about the infection have largely failed to change sexual behaviour, and the number of those with the virus continues to grow. No doubt there are many reasons for this, but one possible factor was highlighted at BTSM in a somewhat provocative presentation by Matthew Dukes. He's the Education Research Coordinator in the Partnership for Child Development, which is based at Imperial College in London. He showed results of research called the CASE Study, which stands for Kenyan Adolescents Sex Education Study. In the preliminary work, he and his colleagues had looked at the level of reasoning skills that teenagers had in everyday situations, how much they actually knew about HIV and its transmission, and at how much control they had over their own lives, all factors that may underpin decisions with regard to sexual behaviour.
First of all, we spend a lot of time talking to children and just eliciting their opinions about these factors. And then we went on to try and develop measures of them in the form of basic questionnaires. And then we tried to relate this to their self-reported sexual behaviour. And what we find in relationship to the outcomes is that for knowledge and for skills in our pilot study, there's a relationship to sexual behavior for girls, but not for boys, which means that on the whole, we find that the girls who know more about HIV are less likely to be engaged in sex at this young age. Whereas for boys, whether boys know a lot about HIV or not, they're equally likely to be engaging in sex.
So what would you say the implications of that are then, bringing this back to the scientific mind?
Well, one implication could be that girls are more rational in their thinking about sexual behaviour, in that the knowledge that they're given, they use in their thinking about sexual behaviour, whereas men appear to be less rational. And in fact, there's good evidence in other aspects of the scientific literature that men can be less rational and temporarily are more likely to forget their long-term goals.
So, yeah, tell me a little bit more about that particular piece of research then.
Well, psychologists have been studying one form of rational decision-making in which people are offered a certain amount of money, which they are able to have right now, or alternatively, they are offered a larger amount of money for which they will have to wait. But how this relates to sexual decision-making, a study came out last year, and they found that after looking at pictures of pretty women, men were more likely to go for the I want the money right now option.
So all it took was for them to see some pretty ladies, and then before we knew it, their blood was up and they just wanted it straight away, the money, that is.
Yeah, at least they were more likely to do this. And it's perhaps of no surprise to find that men's decision about sex is influenced by whether or not they find women attractive. But the really interesting thing is that this transfers to another domain of thinking. So it does seem to suggest that there is something more general going on in the brain, which perhaps makes them value more immediate rewards over delayed rewards.
And this obviously then is relevant for your work looking at HIV/AIDS, because that is directly to do with sexual behaviour.
Yes, the rewards for safe sexual behaviour really couldn't be more distant. There's a relatively small probability for each sex act that you'll contract HIV, and it will take a number of years, possibly, before this will affect your health.
Now, your research on the case study is very preliminary. It's been a pilot study, I think, but what kind of inferences do you think you could already start to draw in terms of applying these insights to further research or tackling the problem in practical ways?
Well, the sort of things we'd like to now explore are the possibility of designing different education interventions for boys and for girls, and particularly looking at ways to get boys to behave more rationally, in particular to teach them ways in which they can keep those long-term goals in mind even in the heat of the moment. And there's been some basic preliminary work looking at methods to achieve this.
And the positive thing perhaps is that if girls are apparently more rational and respond more to their knowledge in their behaviour, then that perhaps means that you can also target girls more easily for HIV/AIDS prevention messages more effectively, perhaps.
Well, I think this is a positive to take from this. Research across the continent has found girls tend to have limited power over their own decisions. But I think the results of our pilot study are quite promising in that they seem to suggest that the girls who do have more knowledge are more likely to behave safely.
Matthew Jukes, who maintains that rationality is a key attribute of the scientific mind. But if females are perhaps more rational, that doesn't necessarily mean they're more inclined towards the study of science. It's a fact that women are generally underrepresented in the scientific community, and girls tend to shy away from the more technical and mathematical subjects at school. The abstract thinking which is required perhaps puts them off, according to Elisa Bolches. She's a secondary school physics teacher and an information technology teacher in higher education. She presented the BTSM group with the conclusions of her PhD research, and it was called Example-Based Education, A Bridge to Abstract Thinking, Especially for Girls. In Dr. Bolcher's own experience, she found that girls did respond well in physics classes if the usual teaching methods were changed. So she investigated. She began by searching through results of tests carried out by the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. They had tested Dutch teenagers on their abilities in maths, a vital tool in the further study of physics. But they had also asked the students how they felt about their achievements. And here, there was a glaring difference between the sexes.
Dutch boys are better in math than the average of the OECD, and they feel themselves better. But for girls, it's totally different. They are better than the overall average of the OECD in math results, but they feel themselves worse. And that's an extremely large difference. So when a girl gets a good result from math, she thinks, yes, but I don't really understand math. And when a boy gets the same good results, he said, yes, I excel in math. The same result, but totally different feelings about that. So girls give in more easily to the uncertainty, and that's the big difference to choose a technical study.
Girls just are simply less confident when it comes to these areas of intellectual ability.
Yeah, that's the great difference. The feelings, and nowadays we accept multiple intelligences. So when you use the cognitive intelligence as mathematical, logical thinking, you have to use your emotional and social intelligence as well. So you trust more your feelings. When you trust your feelings, it implies uncertainty.
So because girls are perhaps a little more in touch with their social feelings than boys are, they listen more, they pay more attention to the uncertainty that those feelings are sort of telling them than the boys do to whatever signals they're getting.
Yes. And you have to teach from the uncertainty of the student and not from the certainty of the teacher. Then you learn a lot of things. And when you teach physics in such a way girls like it, then boys likes it too. But it's not vice versa.
So explain what you mean about teaching from uncertainty rather than teaching from the position of confidence of the teacher.
In the old mode of knowledge production, mostly the teacher start the lesson with the main points, the outlines in physics lessons, the formula. Then after that, he gives the examples. And I investigated to turn it around. So you have to start with the examples and you have to analyze from the examples the outlines, the formula in physics lessons. And the examples have to come from examples of daily life.
So can you give me an example of an example that you might use in one of your physics classes?
Okay. A long time ago, I taught Snellius law. It's the fraction of light in a plate of glass. And when I taught that lesson, I invited the students to come with me to the sport field. And there was a section of sand, loose sand. On the grass, at one side of the section sand, I put a flag. At the other side of the section sand, I put another flag. And I asked the students to run so quickly as possible from flag to flag.
And looking at a diagram, the flags are not directly opposite each other across the sand.
No.
They're at quite a steep angle, so running across the sand would actually involve running across quite a distance of sand.
Yeah, and all of them, they run in straight direction till they came to the border of the sand. At that moment, all of them make a bend. They diffract. So it cost them less energy. They took the quickest way and not the shortest way. And light do the same. So when you explain Snellius law on this way, everybody understands it. It's their own experience. You feel it's true. And so you use more of your intelligences. You need your emotional and social intelligence as well.
So you've been applying this to students of your own, but I think you've also been encouraging other teachers to try and adopt this technique. Have you done some kind of follow-up to see the effects that this has had?
Yeah. A few girls choose a so-called study program, a profile in technical studies. I asked them to give a figure for all the four study programs we have in the Netherlands. And the average figure of the girls for physics lessons was about 4, in the range from 1 till 10. And after a half year, they got example-based physics, this method. It rises significantly from 4 to 5.5. So this figures, that was, they like it. I have other figures, and that is, they pass the test better.
Elisa Bolches. And there's more on her methods on the Radio Netherlands website this week. I'll give the address at the end of the programme. The Building the Scientific Mind Colloquium, or BTSM, was graced by the presence of someone who has not only achieved greatness in his own field of science, but who has made significant contributions to fostering a scientific way of thinking in others. Leon Lederman was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1988. Among his many other activities, he has been very much involved with promoting the public understanding of science and with science education. He told me how and why, in his view, certain key aspects of education are vital for scientific minds. Among them, the history of science.
I think you can't teach science without teaching history. If you have students studying science who are not going to be scientists, and that's the vast majority of the students like that, they'll remember the stories you tell. They'll remember the heroes, the heroines. They'll forget the formulas and the methodology. So therefore, you have to leave them with something important, which shapes their way of thinking. And I think that's in the stories.
In addition, though, you also strongly advocate mathematics as the basis for a real scientific mind, something that many people might feel is contrary to what you've just said about the stories being important, because they seem to be so sort of disparate and mathematics seems so difficult to many people, whereas storytelling is something that inherently comes naturally. So how do you reconcile those two?
Well, the difference, I think, is that mathematics should be part of a child's life from the very beginning, because so many different studies tell you that a comfort level with mathematics is crucial to the future of the child. You could tell stories for kindergarten, for first graders. I ever run a program in Chicago to teach primary school teachers how to teach science to children. And there's wonderful things, exciting things that children can do in early grades, which builds in the beginnings of that scientific mind we're talking about. Funny things like, jelly beans, you know, many multicolored jelly beans, a big picture on the teacher's desk. And these kids work in little groups, and each of them takes 2 handfuls of jelly beans, and the 4 collaborators put them on the table and organize the jelly beans. And then the teacher might say, anybody have a black jelly bean? Nobody has a black jelly bean. Well, suppose you went back and you took another handful. Could you have a black jelly bean? No, maybe there are no jelly beans. Well, then one kid finds a black jelly bean in his group. Oh, yeah, there is. They exist. Well, why didn't you have any? Well, they're rare. So they discuss the contribution of the various colors to the jelly beans. Well, that's maybe not learning about the science of jelly beans, but it's learning how to answer questions.
And it's learning about probabilities and mathematical concepts to do with statistics and so on in a very practical way.
Exactly that. And there are so many such programs. A favorite one is soap bubble. So each kid has a little detergent. They have a stopwatch, and they make the bubbles, and they throw the bubbles at each other, and they're playing. They finally settle down, and when they catch a bubble in a little wire hoop, they start the watch, and when the bubble breaks, they stop the watch, and they record 6 seconds, and they do this 30 or 40 times, and they're measuring the lifetime of a soap bubble. And they make a graph of how many bubbles are alive after 2 seconds, 3 seconds, 4 seconds, and then they discuss it. The teacher says, what's the chance that a bubble will live 20 seconds? One table raises their hand. They say, we have an 18-second. okay, well, 18 is possible. Probably 20 is possible if we played longer. You didn't let us play long enough. So they get, again, distributions. What's the most probable? You know, if you had to guess on how long a bubble will live, well, they look at the peak of their curve and they say 12 seconds, that's the best. Things like that begin their study of science in a serious way because they're setting out to measure something and draw conclusions from what they did. A little bit later, you have to tell them facts that have to be taught, but also thinking. On all of this, the concentration is on children thinking. And between all of these things, the early science, the mathematics, we will get the scientific mind.
Leon Lederman. Aside from education, one of Professor Lederman's activities involves collaborating with colleagues from developing countries, particularly in Latin America. The issue of science and the scientific mind as a factor in development was very much in the frame at BTSM, especially for Paula Monjane. She's from Mozambique, where she works as the Knowledge Management Director with an NGO called the Foundation for Community Development, which supports technical and financial aspects of implementing development projects. Paula said she attended the meeting in The Hague because she wanted exposure to the perspectives of people from different parts of the world and because the possible contributions of science and a scientific education to the development of her country has never been very high on the agenda.
I think we, as in the developing countries, we tend to stay behind of the issues that are important to be discussed. And as a part of facilitating rule of FTC, we felt that some of the issues like this should be brought to the country to be dealt and to be discussed. Personally, I believe that science and particularly knowledge is one of the main contributions that a country or, let's say, a society will have to develop and be in the same boat in the future. And I think that we have lots of contributions to give in all this debate.
A lot of the discussion at the colloquium has been fairly abstract, but there have been some definite results coming out of it. What are you now hoping to do with the ideas and the information and the contacts that you've got out of coming to this meeting?
Well, the first thing is about networking, that it was very useful to have. The second, as FDC, we have an education project. And I have a concrete idea of establishing a link with one group that is trying to pilot materials on education and science. The third thing will be to also to bring all this idea of building scientific mind within communities for children and for adults, and how they think and how they look to all these issues of scientific mind.
And I think that you're also hoping to do that at quite a high level within the country, not just immediately in your local area, but perhaps take it even to the government level.
Yes, one idea also was to work with the Minister of Education and the Science and Technology and look what are the strategies to grow this idea of scientific mind.
And why do you think that having something called a scientific mind would benefit your country folk in Mozambique?
Well, it will benefit for various reasons. For instance, I think it would push forward issues and things beyond looking for problems of, let's say, today. And sometimes we lose the idea of solving and understanding problems that will bring us a development in long term, yes.
So it's a question of developing skills and a way of approaching the world that allows you to look further ahead and prepare better for the future.
In a sustainable way, yes.
Paula Monjane. Now, she mentioned establishing links with a group that's piloting a project on education in science. In fact, Paula offered to try and arrange for schools in Mozambique to test a series of workbooks that aim to lay some of the basic groundwork in maths and physics. The project is the brainchild of Roy McQueenie, Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Chemistry at the University of Pisa in Italy. The idea is to make the workbooks available through the internet, with the first versions of the first four in the series already online. So I met Professor McQueenie in the computer room at the Institute for Social Studies in The Hague, where the Building the Scientific Mind meeting was held, to get a quick overview.
I've actually been nursing this goal for the last 40 years with the intention of making a book on a journey through science. And it was only in the context of the developing world that I really thought I must really start getting this material down.
I guess the point is that the time is now ripe, the technology is there in terms of the internet and being developed
Absolutely.
Further to be able to really take this idea and make it a reality that's usable for as wide a group of people as possible.
Yes, and this particular project, all the modules are confined to a limited area of science. The first one on number and symbols, the beginnings of mathematics.
Because we've got this up on the internet just here, so let's open workbook number one, number and symbols. Okay, there it is.
And this goes from the idea of counting to abstract algebras.
So you've been working on a very definite idea, and you've brought this to the Building the Scientific Mind colloquium.
Yes.
In terms of taking your project forward now, I think there have actually been some practical consequences resulting out of the networking that's been going on in this group,
indeed.
Haven't there?
Yes, well, I've been talking to people from Mexico and Spain and Canada and so on, all over the world, and everybody is enthusiastic about the idea of getting this kind of educational material to places where it's needed most. Lots of offers of help, Spanish translation and so on. We hope to get both translators and more authors.
And I think designers of various kinds, educational designers, graphic designers,
yes.
to add imagery that's meaningful in order to take better advantage of the medium of the internet to actually make it visually more
visually
interesting and attractive.
Yes, yes.
So as far as you're concerned, it's been a very worthwhile experience coming
yes,
to the colloquium.
Yes, yes indeed.
Roy McQueenie. And those first four preliminary workbooks are available online through the Workbooks in Science section on www.paricenter.com. That's paricenter.com. Now, at the end of the Building the Scientific Mind colloquium, I caught up with the organiser, Jan Visser. Was he pleased at the way it all went?
Well, on the practical side, it was quite rewarding to see that after 4 days, people stepped forward and said, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Now, what are they going to do? First of all, across the globe, in countries like Mozambique, Russia, India, there are already now clearly defined intentions to create a follow-up to the Building the Scientific Mind colloquium that we did here, focusing on the problems of their particular society or the society of their region. There's also a commitment of everyone to continue to interact with each other. So a community has emerged from this work. And we will be working on specific issues also, this debate on what actually is it, the scientific mind. So those are some of the immediate outcomes.
And I guess having got the ball started in its role, you would like it to actually gather a few more bits of moss, if I can mix all my metaphors. I guess you would like to attract other people to get involved even now.
We definitely want, and this is an opportunity to actually invite people who are interested in this to visit the website, Building the Scientific Mind. They can become as much a member of the community as those who were here. Please be welcome.
Links to that site can also be found on our own web pages this week, along with a story about Elisa Bolcher's research into example-based education helping girls with physics. The address, as always, is www.researchfile.nl. Now, Anne Blair Gould will be hosting the show next week, and I'll be back with you in mid-June. So, until then, from me, Laura Durnford, bye for now.
This has been a Radio Netherlands presentation.